Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of June. The National Congress of American Indians is meeting in Milwaukee. Today is their final day, and the president is going to be with us momentarily to talk about a variety of issues: education, health care, environmental protection, economic opportunity, and more. The second hour of the program, we thought it was time to turn our attention to Wisconsin once again. February and March were dominated with news about Governor Walker's budget repair bill, but we have a lot of news this week with the budget being passed by the Assembly in the wee hours of this morning and going to the Senate, where it will be passed and probably signed into law tomorrow. The words collective bargaining, public employee unions, and recall elections back in the headlines. We'll be talking about the Wisconsin AFL-CIO and a coalition of unions filing suit in federal court seeking to block collective bargaining law in the state. And we have all kinds of issues to talk about with the news from Wisconsin, so we thought we would focus our attention on that, hour number two. This hour of the program, we're delighted to have with us in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee the president of the National Congress of American Indians, Jefferson Keel, who is well known for his service to Indian country and this country, the United States, inducted into the Military Memorial Museum Hall of Honor on June 13th in Oklahoma. The museum recognizes individuals whose achievements are exemplary, both military and civilian, and it recognizes his actions as an Army Ranger and artillery officer, also as Lieutenant Governor of the Chickasaw Nation and President of the national organization that's meeting this week in Milwaukee. He served as a platoon sergeant and platoon leader both in peacetime and in combat, served two extended tours of duty in the 1st Cavalry Division and the 101st Airborne Division in Vietnam, and received numerous awards and decorations for heroism, two Purple Hearts, the Bronze Star with V for Valor, and the Army Commendation Medal with Valor. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Jefferson Keel, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Before we start with the many issues, I want to talk about being with Michelle Obama at the Garden, because it sounded like a wonderful event and Native Americans were honored.
That was absolutely a thrill for me. Not only to meet the First Lady, but to see Indian country represented in such a fashion, in such a way, and have the children there to interact with the First Lady and her emphasis on health care and let's just move Indian country, and to see the faces of those Indian children and the First Lady and her true, genuine interest in caring for us. It was just absolutely thrilling. Thank you, though.
Yeah. So did you harvest or did you plant?
We did both. We started with an explanation of the three sisters. We called the three sisters corn, the beans, and squash, and their relationship and how they work together to produce food for us to benefit from. And then the children actually helped to plant those seeds and then harvest the garden in the White House. And
that's wonderful. It makes a huge difference to do something like that, doesn't it? To actually see where the food comes from, what it comes from, what importance those crops are to our health and well-being. To actually see it, we tend to be fairly removed from that process.
We really do. And then to see the benefits of growing those for our own use, it was just amazing. And it really did. I think it set a really good tone for the children. It's a good learning experience for them to see the relationship that they can have with the earth and the foods, and they can grow their own foods. Real responsibility there.
Tell me about the problem of obesity. She is concentrating attention on that. Tell me about the problem of obesity in Indian Nation.
Well, it's absolutely a challenge that we are facing head on. But it didn't just stem from overnight. You know, the foods that for centuries, for years and years, Indian tribes were removed to reservations, many of them placed in places where they could not grow crops. Crops just simply would not grow in some of those locations. The consequences of that, the federal government started to provide food, donated foods from the United States Department of Agriculture. We refer to them in Indian country as commodities. Those foods have high concentrations of fats. They're not really healthy foods, although they do provide sustainment. But they need to be prepared in such a way that the individuals can benefit from them. As a result, they're very high in starches and carbohydrates. And so, you know, beans, rice, meats, you know, heavy protein, high protein or low protein, high starch and carbohydrates, and many lifestyles then became dependent on those types of foods. Now, or today, we're facing that because even in those nutrition programs, we're seeing fresh foods, fresh vegetables, as part of these farmers market programs for the Department of Agriculture. I think Secretary Vilsack has done just a tremendous job of emphasizing that at the direction of President Obama to help the Indian tribes face this head on and overcome these things. And obesity is just a byproduct of all of that.
Yeah, problem certainly that faces so many people in this country. I was watching a news report last night that looked at, there was something like 780 counties in this country where the life expectancy for women is going down precipitously, and it's because of diet mostly.
It's because of diet, and the obesity leads to so many other health problems, diabetes, heart disease, and so many things that are related to that type of illness. And if we can get the nation moving, if we can get to exercising, starting to eat healthy, then we can reverse that trend. And that's what the First Lady is focused on, particularly in children. And I think it's just a tremendous job that she's doing.
I'm interested in your service in Vietnam, which was a long time ago now, but I'm sure that it stays with you in some ways, and you're a highly decorated Vietnam veteran. Can you tell me about your decision to go to Vietnam and what you carry with you now as a result of that experience?
Well, I entered the military at a very young age. I don't want to be real long-winded, but I joined the National Guard when I was 16 years old.
Oh, my.
And I could not wait. Simply because it, to me, it represented something I wanted to see. I wanted to see the rest of the world. It was an opportunity for me to do that. I realized after the 6 months active duty that college probably didn't fit in my plans. I simply wasn't ready for college. I really couldn't afford it. And so I joined the regular Army, knowing that I didn't know at the time. I really didn't know where Vietnam was located. Mm-hmm. But the Army recruiter told me. He said, you're probably going to go to Vietnam. But for me, it was I enjoyed it. The structure was something that was good for me. I learned so much. I did go to Vietnam. My first tour in 1966, I left there in 1968. Came back and went to Ranger School at Fort Benning, Georgia. And what I refer to jokingly, I go, dude, say all those Rambo things. You know, I did all the Rambo training, and for me, I enjoyed that. But there was a point that I realized I needed an education in order even to advance in the military. And a company commander encouraged me to go to college or to officer training school. And so I got out of the Army, went to college on an ROTC scholarship, and graduated from East Central University in Ada, Oklahoma, and re-entered the military as a field artillery officer and spent the next 10 years as a field artillery officer. And then I retired in 1989. During the process, you know, as you know, I received a bachelor's degree. And then before I retired, I received a master's degree from Troy University. And then I came back to serve my people.
Mm. Did you grow up in Oklahoma?
Yes, I did. I graduated from high school, as I said, when I was 16 years old, and entered the military, and And I've returned to Oklahoma. That's where my family was located. Mm-hmm.
The American National Congress of American Indians, you are president of, is meeting in Milwaukee this week. You are taking on a whole host of issues, aren't you?
Yes, ma'am. We really are. The National Congress of American Indians is, we refer to ourselves, we are the oldest and largest Indian organization in the country. It's made up of tribal leaders. Our executive board and the Congress itself is made up of tribes, member tribes across the country. There are around 250 tribes that are members. Our focus is to bring a unified voice to Congress. That's what we're seeking. And in fact, this week is a good effort towards that because there are so many issues that face Indian country, everything from land into trust to health care, justice programs, the violence against women, those border issues. There are so many things that plague Indian country. We're trying to work together to bring a stronger voice to Congress to enact federal legislation that will protect our sovereign rights and help to benefit more and more Indian people.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about education some. It played a crucial role in your development as a human being and as a leader of your community. How are most, and I'm sure it varies from state to state, but are we seeing most Native Americans being educated in public school systems in the country? Are there a number of schools that at least look at the cultural background of Native Americans?
Well, most Indian children in this country are, in fact, educated in public schools. However, there are what we call BIA Indian schools that are operated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs or Bureau of Indian Education. Those are located on Indian reservations for the most part. We have one in Santa Fe, in New Mexico. We have one in Window Rock, Arizona, and other places around the country. Those schools do, in fact, include cultural subjects within the curriculum. The problem that we have in many schools, though, is the tribal leaders and the local community don't really have a say in the development of the core curriculum. And so oftentimes there's a disconnect between the cultural education and the college prep that we see. Most high schools in this country are designed, in fact, almost all of them are, for college preparation. The fact of the matter is, you know, there's a great number of our children who never go to college, although the idea is that they'll be prepared if they do choose. But all of them are going to enter into the workforce at some point. Mm-hmm. So we need them prepared. Our focus is to help those tribes who want to develop other types of curriculums to help their students get into the technology fields, whether it be a trade or other type of vocational school. We need some emphasis on that too. Although the focus, as you know, is on the secondary education and college prep and that sort of thing. So there's some diverse tracks that we need to take. But we do need to protect the interests of all of our students. We need to get them prepared if they want to go to college. And our idea is that money should not be the reason why these children do not get a college education. They need to be prepared, and they need to have the opportunity and be prepared when that opportunity presents itself, as well as we need to give them the tools to succeed.
Would you like to see a change in the way the BIA administers schools in Indian country?
Well, we're working very closely with the Bureau of Indian Education and the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs to do exactly that, to look at the curriculums, to include the tribal leaders, the local tribal leaders in the development of those curriculums so that they are prepared and that they are doing a better job of taking care of our children. And I believe that we're making some real progress. and along those lines.
Let's talk about gaming. I know it's not a focus of the conference in any huge way, but it has made a huge difference in the state of Wisconsin in terms of the amount of money coming to Indian Country, in terms of education, in terms of health, in terms of economic development. It's pretty big in this state, and I'm sure that it is in other parts of this country as well.
Yes, ma'am. Indian gaming has become the lifeline of many of our communities. It provides a revenue stream for tribes to engage in some activities that they were never allowed to do before. And as well as you mentioned, it provides for the economy of the Indian tribe. It also provides a tremendous impact for the local communities. Every dollar that's produced or that's realized in a particular area, for instance, turns over several times in a community. And so the local community benefits from that economic rise, if you want to refer to it that way. Our focus in Indian Country is to make sure that the tribes benefit from that, because we take that money that's realized, the proceeds, the net profits, if you want to refer to it in that sense, but we reinvest that into our own people. We provide them with scholarships to go to college. We provide them with health care insurance that they can't afford otherwise. We can provide them with other types of services and programs that the federal government, although it has an obligation to provide, many times does not because of a lack of resources. So it is something that's very important, and it's a tremendous impact on the local communities as well as the Indian tribes.
As you look at seven generations, would you like for there to be another source of income? Is it okay to be tied to gaming for seven generations to come?
Well, I think most Indian tribes look at Indian gaming as simply a vehicle to get us to the point where we are. We have an independence, a financial independence, to get away from that total dependence on the federal government. Many tribes are realizing that today. I think tribes look at diversifying their business interests. Tribal gaming gives us that opportunity. It provides us revenue to invest in other businesses and develop other businesses so that we are not totally dependent on Indian gaming. And I'll give you an example of that. If you look at the Chickasaw Nation, for instance, I'll just simply talk about my tribe.
Sure.
We own a chocolate factory. We own a metal fabrication plant, and some other interests. So, and we're also getting out of the box, if you want to refer to it as a box. And we're not simply looking at a total dependence on gaming. So we're looking at other types of businesses. The fact is, though, that the gaming revenues have enabled us to do that.
You don't have any of that chocolate in your pocket, do you?
I do not, but I'm often asked by our NCAI staff and others who have tasted it. It is very tasty, and I'm often asked about it, so I'll send you some.
Will you really?
I will.
Oh, yay! Thank you. Chrissy is saying, yeah, we'll have some more chocolate lovers. Thank you, sure. Sir. We'll welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. The National Congress of American Indians meeting wrapping up today in Milwaukee, and the president of the organization is joining us in our Milwaukee studios, Jefferson Keel of the National Congress of American Indians. It is the country's oldest and largest American Indian and Alaska Native advocacy organization. And we'll be with you in a moment. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming at the second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about all that's going on in the Wisconsin legislature and collective bargaining, the budget. So that's our focus, our number two. We go to phone calls now. 800-486-8655 is our number. Eugene from Viola is our first caller for you.
I just have one question, and I'll get off the line.
All right.
How successful have the tribes been in buying back land that in a lot of cases were taken from them illegally generations ago within the reservations and also outside the reservations? And I'll take my answer off.
All right, Eugene, thank you.
Many tribes have began that process. You're absolutely right. Many of the lands were either taken illegally or in some cases unethically or by any other means. But many tribes are beginning that process to repurchase the land. There is an issue of taking that land out of fee and putting it into trust. Sometimes that's a real challenge. It's happening in different parts of the country, but it's, as you can imagine, it's a very slow, deliberate process. Many of those landowners, those private landowners, simply do not want to sell, and so it just takes time and resources to accomplish that.
Thanks, Eugene, for your call. Jim is next in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I'd like to ask a question about the process that you've been describing. Do you think that could apply also to a small rural community that is trying to create its own self-sustainability, jobs and such?
The process, what process are you mentioning?
The processes for trying to create local, your own health care, your own jobs and things like that.
Okay.
I think that's a real challenge. I know that in some areas of the country, in fact, in Oklahoma, we work really well with the state health department to help establish clinics. And I'll give you another example. We have, and now this may not be the real answer or true answer to your question, but we have interest or people who want to establish clinics to serve those who are underserved, who don't have insurance, or maybe have work somewhere. They're non-Indians and they work for a tribe, and so we're establishing a clinic in my tribe to serve those employees who are not eligible to work to go to the Indian Health Clinic or to get services from the Indian Health Services, participate in an insurance program. So we're trying to help that. Now, in terms of developing those resources from a private group, I think you would have to work through your local, maybe the Chamber of Commerce, your local county or state government in order to accomplish that. I don't know that there's a federal program that would allow for that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. Lines are open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. I was interested in one of the sessions, and there have been several on this, preparing for the upcoming Farm Bill, the Food Conservation and Energy Act. It was a focus of at least one of your sessions. What is that act, and how does it affect Indian country?
Well, the Energy Act. You may have heard that I'll talk about the energy bill primarily. The farm bill simply enables farmers to continue. We want to continue to receive the subsidies and help farmers to realize their gains and enable us to the Indian farmers to continue to operate in the absence. We don't want to become subject to all the large farming industries. You know, in many tribes, many people simply cannot afford those $150,000 cultivators and those types of things. So it's a matter of enabling Indian farmers. The energy bill, you may have heard Senator Dorgan, you may have heard him before, talk about energy development in Indian country. There are resources. The Indian country has approximately 10% of the resources in this country.
10%?
I think it's around 10% that are contained within Indian reservations or Indian country. Yet we're really unable to realize, maybe drill for oil or gas, any of those resources, coal, because of so many federal regulations. In fact, the three affiliated tribes in North Dakota had oil and gas reserves on their reservation, yet there were 49 federal agencies that had to agree and approve the process for them to drill. And
49 agencies? 49. You're kidding me. Oh, my gosh.
And so you talk about this bureaucratic maze that tribes have to try to navigate. And so it just takes a tremendous amount of time and effort. And in the past, tribes have simply given up. They simply have just run out of time and patience, or they can't afford the lawyers to guide them through the process. Well, we're trying to remove many of those barriers. And we've asked, I asked in my State of the Indian Nations address in January, if the United States, if Congress would allow us to do the things that we can do to remove those barriers and help us to develop our own resources, then we can build a stronger America. We can participate in energy development. Everything from wind to coal to fossil fuels to oil and natural gas, all of those things tribes can participate in. We have the resources. We simply need the ability to develop those resources.
And I would imagine you have the rights to those resources.
Yes, absolutely. And there's another issue that comes along with that, and it has to do with water. Water is becoming more valuable than oil. And you know, and we have a saying in Oklahoma, that oil, water is actually more necessary than oil. You can live without oil, but you can't live without water. And so we need to make sure that we protect our resources, the aquifers that regenerate, so that they're not polluted, and that we can actually utilize those water resources.
That's an issue that comes and goes, doesn't it? We're just not paying enough attention, and I would imagine that it is a big issue on Western reservations. Isn't that where the problem is the greatest, or is it everywhere?
I think it's around the country. Across the country, it's an issue. It doesn't get a lot of attention on the national scene, but I think in local communities, it becomes a major issue, and it is a huge issue in California, in Arizona, in the western mm-hmm. states where their resources are scarce already, being overutilized in many other areas. Oklahoma, we're simply squabbling. You know, if you look at Dallas, Texas, and North Texas, and some of these other metropolitan areas that are they're just exploding with housing. And the water needs are just tremendous. They need water from somewhere. And so tribes have a right to those water. We have a right to make sure that our interests are protected. It's a sovereign right. And going back to the purpose of this conference, when we talk about resources, we talk about our sovereign rights. We talk about the climate change that people really don't want to acknowledge. If you look at Alaska, for instance, we have native villages falling off into the ocean. And there are just so many things that have to do with energy, all of those resources that we need to protect. It simply can be overwhelming. But we're trying to take those one at a time and work through those.
What you said is so dramatic just now. We have native villages falling into the ocean. How much attention are we paying to that? Almost none.
Very little in the lower 48. In fact, there are senators and congressmen who say that's a hoax, that the global warming is a hoax or fluke. Regardless of whether you believe that or not, and whether you're being coached to say that, the fact of the matter is, if you go and visit some of those locations, you can see for yourself. We need to develop our own resources and get away from this total dependence on oil from the Middle East and other places. That's something that we'll continue to work with. Now, in Indian country, we have to focus on our own issues. Mm-hmm. We simply take these as a as a challenge. And we have so many challenges in Indian country that we simply have to work together to make a difference. And that's when we talk about our unified voice.
We go to Nancy in Greendale. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. What I want to talk about may seem a little trivial in regard to the great big issues, but the distinction between using the terminology Native American and Indian or American Indian, I've been amused that Kathleen, following media plans, I guess, kept saying Native American. Your guest is saying Indian.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. What terminology is it all okay or not? Is it something preferable?
I think for me, it's okay. I grew up as an Indian boy in southern Oklahoma. I think when we talk about the political correctness, there was a time not too many years ago when you have the Asian Indians, the people from India, because there's such a population that's growing in this country, they wanted to make sure there was a distinction. And so instead of calling them Indians, they would say, well, they're Native Americans or the first Americans. And the same thing with the Alaskans. They're Alaska Natives instead of referring to all of them as Eskimos because they're not all Eskimos. And so it just has to do with political correctness. I think most Indian people around this country would not be offended if you call them Indians.
I like First Americans. It has a nice ring to it, doesn't it?
It has a nice ring. I think it's probably the most proper.
Right, exactly. Thanks, Nancy, for your call. We go next to Jennifer in Waupun, Iowa. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning. I was calling. I kind of have a selfish reason for calling, I guess. Probably about three generations ago, there was some interracial relations between an Indian and another member of my dad's side of the family. And it was only one person, and it happened, that far back. However, when people look at me, they automatically assume I come from a highly Hispanic community, and they assume that I'm Hispanic because I have that dark skin tone and the dark hair coloring and everything. And I'm not, and, I know that it comes from this Native American that's back in my family. But I want to know, am I being disrespectful if I claim that I am part Native American, even though the percentage of it is, not high?
I don't think that's disrespectful at all. I think that's being honest and true to your own self. The fact of the matter is that in this country is a melting pot of civilizations, and a lot of intermarriages took place a long time ago. We have people around the country that experience the same thing that you're simply talking about. I don't think it's being disrespectful at all. I think that you should be proud of that.
Thank you, Jennifer. We go to Sharon next. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Hi.
I hope I can tell you this. 49 years ago, I lived on the Navajo Reservation. I was a guidance counselor in a BIA school. I was there for 2 years. It was the best master's program I've ever experienced. Of course, it wasn't, but I mean, you didn't get a degree afterwards, but I grew up. It was very eye-opening. And when I came home to Wisconsin, the Indians here were, I don't know if they were treated differently, but they were certainly not nearly as well off as those on the Navajo or the Hopi reservations. And I think it's still true in Dakota. We've sent care packages and things like that there at Christmas time. I wonder if, and just an aside, I've seen the documentary that showed the Indian villages going into the sea. It is actual. It's not fiction.
I've seen that as well. I know. Shame on us for not paying attention.
It's really serious, but I would like this gentleman to comment, or if he knows about the great differences in the economic status of the tribes in the different areas of the United States.
Thank you for that question, and I'll do the best I can to try to answer your question. I think when you look at the diversity in Indian country, from part of it has to do with geography. Part of it has to do with the tribal government makeup and how they're organized, and what the individual tribal government does for its people and how they serve their people. And part of it has to do with the progressive nature of those Indian tribes in different parts of the country. There are some tribes around the country who are extremely progressive. They look at tribal self-governance. Indian Education and Assistance Act that was passed in 1975 allowed tribes to begin to determine for themselves how they wanted their government to move forward. There are many tribes who simply do not want to move in that direction. They simply, as one tribal leader told me several years ago, they are stuck on principle. They believe they have a treaty with the United States of America, and they simply want the United States to live up to its treaty. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I don't disagree with that. However, if you look at treaties, those treaties that would say that the tribe that the United States has an obligation to the tribe to provide education, housing, health care, and other basic human rights, nowhere in that treaty will it say they'll provide you with a quality education or a high quality health care or beautiful housing. Or safe and decent housing. It simply has those terms. And so for years, we've had this great divide in how Indian country moves forward. Tribal governments have the sovereign right to determine the direction and how they want to organize and how they want to govern themselves. Now, does that mean that the federal government picks and chooses how they provide for one over another? I don't believe so, but I know that there's been tribes that they've been at great odds with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is the designated agency from the federal government to deal with Indian tribes. And so because of that relationship, this fierce I want to say animosity that exists between the federal government and the Indian tribes, and through those agencies, we've had this great divide over the years. And I really don't know how you overcome that. It didn't happen overnight, so it's going to take a while to overcome.
More phone calls in a moment. Joining us this hour in our Milwaukee studios, Jefferson Keel. And we want to congratulate him. He was very recently inducted into the Military Memorial Museum Hall of Honor. He is the president of the National Congress of American Indians. They are having their mid-year conference and marketplace in Milwaukee, and it's wrapping up today. He has just been reelected to another four-year term as the lieutenant governor of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma, just reelected, and then this week inducted into the Military Memorial Museum Hall of Honor. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our lines have been busy. There are a couple lines open right now. So this is your opportunity. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll talk about what's going on with the state Senate, what has happened with the assembly, the recall elections, the decision by the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, and a number of unions filing suit in federal court seeking to block the cuts in collective bargaining. We have a lot of issues going on in the state, and we will talk about those hour number two. All right. Here's an email that has come in from Gordy. Without income on the reservation, how will we fix things? When I lived on the Pine Ridge Reservation, most families with 2 to 3 children live on $400 to $600 a month with no hope of employment.
Thank you. That is a statement that we've made over and over again. If you look at many of the tribes in Indian country, the unemployment rate is anywhere from 50 to 70%.
And, goodness.
You know, in this country, if we look at the unemployment rate in this country and we say it's at a crisis level, I agree with you, it's at 9 or 10%. If you look at Indian country, many of these reservations, if we could get down to 10%, that would be just a tremendous victory. Economic development in many of these reservation areas is so, so difficult. One of the reasons is when we talk about, you mentioned Indian gaming earlier, we talk about casinos. The problem is in many of these remote areas that there's no people to come to those casinos. So you can build one, but if it's not profitable, then it doesn't serve its purpose. Developing resources on those reservations is often very difficult, as I talked about earlier, the federal bureaucratic maze that we have to go through to get there. So the tribal government and NCAI does work with many of these tribal governments to try to help them locate investors and other developers that will come to their reservations and work with them to try to develop some type of revenue streams or some type of economic development that will create jobs for their citizens. As you know, the best social program is a good job. If we can create jobs in Indian country, then those people can go to work, they can provide for their families. They're not dependent on any type of government, or whether it be the tribal, state, or federal government, to be able to sustain them. And so that's our goal. Our goal is to bring tribal leaders together to talk to investors, to talk about capital resources, to try to develop a sustainable resource for those Indian communities. And I know it's very difficult, and that's, you know, Pine Ridge, Rosebud, all of those in the Great Plains, as well as others across the country, are experiencing that. Not to mention the, you know, on top of that, we have these tremendous disasters, floods, tornadoes, all these others that are plaguing us right now. So it's a very difficult and emotional topic and subject, and I know I didn't do real credit to it, but we'll continue to work with tribal leaders to help that. And I would ask that you go to the NCAI website. It's www.ncai.org. And there are different areas that you can look at to maybe help you, and you can, anyone on the staff, if you have questions that we can help you with, we'd be glad to interact with you.
We had an interesting guest yesterday, not that we haven't talked about this issue before, but really calling for another kind of Great Depression FDR government program to put people to work on reservations everywhere in America, that we need to rethink unemployment benefits and instead look at, really, and I agree with you, having a job. You got to have a job for your own sense of well-being, for being able to provide for yourself and your family, to fill your days, to feel good about your life. Jobs are so crucial. Have you taken that issue on at all in the conference? Would you be supportive of a government program that would put people to work?
Absolutely. You know, the old WPA that you're talking about, the Works Project, Work Projects Administration, that was a tremendous help. Even those folks, you know, during the Great Depression, we believe, and I believe, I'll say we, I believe that innovation is the key to survival. We have to be innovative and creative, and if that's something that we can focus on to help create some of those jobs, absolutely we'll support it. And I know that tribal leaders around the country would love to be involved in that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Green energy. James in Madison. Hi.
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 Yes. My question is, I wondered if you, what your thoughts were on the fact, and my understanding is a significant portion of Indian economy across the country, or more specifically in Wisconsin at least, is based on gaming. And kind of the issue that, in one sense, gaming is sort of a degenerate industry because it doesn't really create technology or sort sort of better cultural society in any way. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that going forward, that whether you thought that was kind of a dead-end industry in a sense.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that earlier, if you want to briefly address it.
Well, I can say that Indian gaming in itself does not I believe that you're right. It doesn't create technology. However, technology contributes to Indian gaming. It's involved in that. The point is that Indian gaming allows tribes to develop a revenue stream and take those revenues or the profits and invest them in ways to diversify their own economies. They can develop other types of businesses that are not necessarily gaming related, whether it be in the technology resource development area. They take those funds and reinvest it into some type of healthcare development or healthcare technology, telemedicine. There's so many things that tribes can invest in today that helps them to be diversified so that we don't have a total dependency on Indian gaming.
Thank you, James, for the call. Beverly is next in Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. Heartfelt congratulations to Mr. Keel. This program has made me very proud of being a listener to public radio. It has alerted me and pushes me forward to learn more about what can be done. And what to appreciate that has been done, but more to appreciate what has to be done. Kudos to Kathleen also. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Beverly. Thank you for the call. Jim in Black Earth. Hi, Jim.
Hi, it's Kim.
Oh, it's Kim. I'm sorry. I misread this. Hi, Kim.
That's all right. Kudos. I agree with that lady that just called. I had a question. For your guest, you all have, your Indian nations have all of this, I'm assuming, lots of acres and acres and acres, and a lot of water. You had mentioned natural gas. As I understand it, natural gas is extracted from fracking. And so I'm wondering, when you were saying water is very coveted and precious, and you all were talking about how important water is. I was thinking within the country, I'm sorry, I've got a tractor in the background. Within the country, there are people that are coming up very, very sick, and they can't leave there because of the right to the mineral rights. Even though people own their land, they can go in and they can just frack anywhere, and people have to put up with it, and it's killing people. I wondered if you could make a comment about whether the Indian reservations and nation would just not tolerate that kind of extracting natural resources for fuel.
Thank you for that question. And in fact, there have been a number of discussions surrounding that exact issue. And the tribal leaders on those reservations and that own those resources have been very adamant and very much opposed to any type of development that would endanger any of the local communities and their health. It's an ongoing problem. It's not one that'll be quickly solved. If you know, as you are aware, the oil and gas industry in this country are the real movers and shakers, and they have a lot of influence in Congress and how how the federal government shapes its federal rules and regulations and laws. And so we're not at the advantage here in Indian country, but we still will work very hard with all of the Congress on both sides of the aisle to make sure that our local communities are protected.
Mm-hmm. We have somebody online who can't stay with us, somebody on hold, wants to know more about the Chickasaw Industries. And somebody, I think because of our response, wants to buy chocolate. Is there a way to do that?
If you go to our website, it's www.chickasaw. I believe you go to chickasaw.net.
Okay.
And go to our website, and it'll prompt you to the right places. The Chickasaw Nation Industries is a corporation. It's owned by the Chickasaw Nation, and it is a a tremendous organization that engages in federal contracting. It owns some businesses and data collection, data management, and some other things. So healthcare. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good question as far as chocolate. It's called Bedre Chocolate.
Okay.
Bedre, and it's owned by the Chickasaw Nation. It's located right now in Paul's Valley, Oklahoma, but we're looking at expanding that so that we can keep up with the need.
Great. And Chickasaw is Chickasaw. Do you have a marketplace as well as part of your conference?
We did. I think they've already gone.
Oh, it's gone already. Yeah. Okay. And would you be able to put us in touch with some people? I promise you a show on this, on Alaska Native villages going into the sea. Do you know
people?
All right. Thank you. I promise you within a month we're going to do a show on that. That's appalling. There's too much to be concerned about, but that's appalling.
Yes.
It was an absolute honor to speak with you. You are quite a gentleman. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here and wish you all the best.
Thank you. You as well. Jefferson Keel, he's just been reelected to another 4-year term as the Lieutenant Governor of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma, and he is the president of the National Congress of American Indians. They are finishing up their mid-year conference, which has been taking place in Milwaukee today. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your heartfelt and interesting calls. We will continue our conversation, different subject, right after the news, which is coming up momentarily here on the Ideas Network.